You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it, people who have lived, worked, and ministered in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who understand the immense value of the work that God does there. I'm your host, Joe Epley. And this week, I am excited for our guest. We are bringing on Pastor Drew Becker. He currently serves as the superintendent of the Assemblies of God of South Dakota. But before that, he has had an awesome ministry journey of just walking in and out of small town church and seeing what kind of, for lack of a better term, what kind of trouble he can get up to there. What can we innovate? What can we have fun with and all those things? But I'm excited to let him tell you his story. But first, I want to say, Pastor Drew, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Joe. Hey, thanks for having me on. This is going to be fun.
Absolutely. I don't disagree. I think rural has always been and has always been a place of story. And so that's kind of where we're going to start. I would love for you to give us kind of the 5-minute flyover. Talk about your journey in ministry, man. Where'd you come from? How'd you get where you are now? Tell us the stops along the way. And really highlighting through that your connection to the rural church. So start wherever you feel like and let's chat.
Absolutely. I was called into the ministry at the age of 15 on the side of a hill in the Black Hills of South Dakota. It was near Hill City, South Dakota. I was called into ministry, had no idea what that meant, came back from that camp and didn't tell a soul. After that, I was afraid to tell anybody about being called in ministry. Shortly after that, I kind of took a detour in my life and didn't follow the Lord for a while, but I ended up returning to the Lord back in 1988 when I was in college. I wasn't at a Bible college. I was at a university, Morehead State University in Minnesota. And at that college, I came back to the Lord in 88 in my dorm room, and I began to remember the calling of God in my life and began to pursue him about that calling. And, you know, deep down inside, I had a preference inside, and that preference was, I want to live in a big city. But sure. God had a much different plan. While I was in Fargo, I got plugged into a church there and got real involved with the church there. And then I found myself really getting a desire to go to the rural towns. And how that happened was, it was in 1991, I went through a very deep, deep depression for approximately 10 months. I had these intense thoughts of suicide and just deep, deep depression. After probably 8 months of going through that, I was living on Elm Street in Fargo, North Dakota. It's true. I was living on Elm Street. And I was desperate, crying out to God. And as I cried out to God, I said, Lord, what do you want me to do in this life? You remember the song? You probably don't. It was an old song. They remade it this year, Place in This World by Michael W. Smith in 1991. Mm-hmm. And they remade it this year. And I was crying out to God, Lord, show me my place in this world. And I was a map freak back then, just loved maps. I felt like God spoke to my heart, said, lay your hands on the maps of North and South Dakota. So I did. And when I did that, I instantaneously saw this vision of these fires burning all over these towns in North and South Dakota. And there was just a stirring in my heart, knowing that God is wanting to bring revival to the small towns of North and South Dakota. So that was, I would say, the first directive I got from the Lord about going to the small towns. And it was shortly after that, after I went through this deep, dark depression, got free by the power of God, I ended up going to a small town that summer in Lemon, South Dakota. I was there for 2.5 months, got to preach 7 times, and I just really began to get a heart for the small towns of North and South Dakota. Sure. After that, I went back to college, finished, and eventually ended up in an internship back in Fargo, was there for a year, and that desire for small towns began to grow. And after that, I ended up in Beulah, North Dakota. I was in
Beulah.
Good old Beulah land, the land flowing with coal and money. So anyways, Beulah land, I was there for 9 years, started out as a youth pastor, became an associate. And then somewhere along the lines, I got called by God to travel full time. And I, you know, it wasn't logical because it was the year 2000 And we just had our firstborn son, and I resigned my
Sure.
position at the church. So none of it made sense, but I knew I had a burning passion to go to the small towns. And that's when I began to travel to the Dakotas, to the small towns of the Dakotas, town after town after town, mostly North Dakota, some South Dakota, and other states, but mostly North Dakota, where I began to get even a greater passion for the small towns of the Dakotas. And from there, it was shortly after that the Lord spoke to my heart to move back to my hometown, Aberdeen. We were still traveling full time, going from town to town. And I didn't know why I moved back to Aberdeen. And it was a gnawing question inside of my heart. Why am I back in my hometown? After 9 months, I decided to go on a 28-day fast. Had no idea why 28 days, but when I did the 28-day fast, I knew that God had called me to start and plant churches in the Dakotas. And I had her one phrase, hub inside the hub. Drew, I'm calling to be the hub inside the hub. And saw a vision of all these little churches being planted in the Dakotas. So after that 28-day fast, I heard that phrase, Drew, I'm calling you to be the hub inside of the hub. I saw a vision of spokes going out from Aberdeen, which is considered the hub city. A lot of background there, why it's considered the hub city. But nonetheless, I saw that hub and these spokes going out to these small towns. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt we were supposed to start a church in my hometown, Aberdeen, South Dakota. So once my wife got on board with that, she went on a 21-day fast months later, and it was confirmed to us. We launched out in 2006 to start our first church in Aberdeen. And I think we had 91 there our first Sunday, and it grew from there. And it's still going and going strong. But from there, after about 4 years, I remember that we didn't have a building yet. We were
Sure.
meeting in a hotel.
It's kind of crazy after 4 years.
Well, we went 10 years as a
Dang.
church that went from a school to another school, to a hotel, then to another hotel. It was a 10-year journey of setting up, tearing down. And it was somewhere where along the lines where I said, we've no matter if we have a building or not, we've got to start churches in other small towns. And that's when I began to get a vision for Webster, South Dakota. And I didn't know a person in Webster. I didn't know a soul there. But we started praying over the community. And about 3 months into that journey of, just praying, God opened a door. My superintendent, Pastor Steve Shively, called and he said, I know of someone that is moving from Brainerd, Minnesota to Webster, South Dakota.
Sure.
How would you like to connect with them? So I connected with them and I said, I understand you're moving to Webster. I don't know anybody in Webster, but I want to plant a church there. Will you consider helping us out? They said, absolutely. And I said, well, here's what I want you to do. Come to our church for a month in Aberdeen. If you feel like you're a part of us, then I'm going to
Sure.
ask you to help us in this journey. And after about 3 weeks, they said, we're in.
Huh.
So about a year later, we started meeting in their home and started just casting vision and just explain what we're about. In fact, in Aberdeen, that's how we started too. We started in our home with 13 people, grew, and then we ended up in a hotel for a while, meeting with our launch team. And same pattern in Webster, met in a home. And after 9 months, we launched the church there. And for the first 3 years, we didn't have many people. I would say 30 at the most. We saw people get saved. We saw newcomers, but we just weren't growing. And I knew that we needed to find a campus pastor there because I couldn't be there full time. I was still pastoring Aberdeen Church. And we found that campus pastor, Clark Otis. He came and we got a new face and a new place. We started meeting downtown there. And now the church is running probably around close to 70. And
Nice.
that's just what we just continued to do. We continued to we started a church in Redfield then. There was already a gentleman there, Mark Apple, who was already wanting to plant a church. And so we teamed up with him and we launched a church there in Redfield, South Dakota. And then shortly after that, during that time, we adopted a church in Miller, South Dakota. And then we adopted another one in Wakpala. So we had five campuses, and I was kind of shifting over to more of a church planter type overseer before I became a superintendent. So,
Very
yeah.
nice.
Loved it.
Yeah. But yeah, what a journey. I love the vision of saying, hey, we've started this church. It's healthy. Now let's see what we can do in these other small towns. And I'm excited to kind of dive into some of the experience you had in planning those churches. I know that when you were talking about small towns and kind of this idea of how did we break into the community? How did we start the church planning process? You mentioned this kind of community involvement model. You kind of called it your acts of kindness model that you utilized in church planning. But whether it's a church plant or just a church in general, I think that acts of kindness idea is so cool. So could you take some time and just highlight some of the ways that showed up? What was the goal there, and what was the kind of impact you saw from it?
Absolutely. So being a part of Beulah Church, I knew there was a little bit of a reticence between our church and other churches in the community. And the reticence came because we were Pentecostal. And
Sure.
we were unashamed of that Pentecostalism and the move of the Holy Spirit. And it has always been a very strong core value of mine to hunger after a move of God, hunger for revival, renewal. And so, because of that, I knew that there would be in these small towns this sense of like, oh, they're the weird group, they're the cultic group.
Sure.
And I didn't want any of that because my heart really is for winning souls. And so, how we approached it so we wouldn't be that, isolated Pentecostal church that has nothing to do with the community, we, from the very start in Aberdeen, and in Redfield and in Webster, we begin to do acts of kindness. For instance, in Redfield or in Webster, we did various things such as just go to the Chamber of Commerce. What are some of your needs here? And we found out some of the needs. One of them was we need someone to paint the senior center on Main Street. Will you be willing to do that? We'll
Sure.
provide the paint. Will you provide the people? Absolutely. So we did that. And of course, people are driving by wondering who these people are with Freedom Church shirts on and painting this building. And we just started building bridges that way.
Sure.
And that was just one thing. We got involved with the county fair. They needed someone to come and clean off all the benches and paint. And we did that too. So just little by little, chipping away the ice in the community and wanting to be an integral part of that community, picking weeds on Main Street, a variety of, just acts of kindness. One thing we did, a lot of churches have done this, is do the like 30 or 40 or 50 cents off per gallon for gas. And we
Nice.
called it Freedom at the Pumps. And we did it at a strategic time where in this little community of Webster, they had an all community rummage sale. So there's a lot of people out and about that weekend, and that's when we did it. And they continue to do acts of kindness in all of the communities that we have supported, Aberdeen, of course, Redfield, Webster, just to kind of build that bridge on a continual basis with the community. And two, so we as a church don't become inwardly grown, and we just always want to have that expression of that we're here for the community, loving on the people. So
Absolutely. And what I love about all those things is they're really, for lack of a better term, they're just like a consequence of asking. It's like, well, hey, this wasn't a hard thing. This wasn't the overly spiritual thing. It's just like, well, let's try and do something and do something good that answers a need. And like that is attainable through really any pastor, any size of church. Like you can find some people in a way to do well. So, I do have
absolutely.
a question for you. And this is kind of it starts as a negative, but I really view it as a positive. But I want to talk about the role of like desperation in a rural church, right? In a small town church. I think that I use that term more affectionately than others would, because I do think in a small town, especially if you've been there longer and longer and longer, you might start to go, well, how can I reach these people? You might hit multiple false starts or dead ends, or you've tried things, or you just feel like the people in the church are hungry for something, because they recognize, oh, if we die or the town dies, there can be this kind of underlying hunger for God to do something good. And I think sometimes as pastors, we fight against that and we say, oh man, the situation looks bleak, and we kind of lean into the pessimism of it. But in a perfect world, we might say, what is the flip side of desperation if not opportunity? And so maybe just, I don't know, talk about that a little bit. How can a pastor view that sometimes that desperate situation of a small town as a good thing?
Absolutely. I remember as an evangelist traveling full time, I was in a small town community, and the pastor was telling me about being at a ministerium meeting in the small town in North Dakota. And one of the pastors that was at the ministerium, he stood up and said, "Hey, everyone, we have to just admit this, console the people in our community that our town is shutting down, that our
Wow.
town is spiraling down quickly, and we just have to we have to really comfort the people about that." And I when he told me that happened in that pastor's meeting, I said, "Wow, what a great vision that is. That really that
Sure.
just is so inspiring." And I took that, and it just inspired me so much to begin to cast vision in these small towns. And I think as a pastor, leader, you have to be the visionary leader. You have to be the one that gets in the quiet place with God and stays there until God speaks to you from heaven, saying, "This is what I want to do in this community." And you getting the heavenly vision through prayer, and if fasting's required, do that. I have not started a church or have not seen some progress or advancement without prayer and fasting. It's just been a big part of my life, a part of every planting adventure I've been on. And I don't see that where that's going to change because there are certain atmospheres in a community that will never change unless someone comes in there and goes after God with all their heart, seeks him through prayer and fasting, and says, "God, what is it that you want to do in this community?" I think of, Daniel when he prayed and fasted, and it after 21 days, the angel finally broke through type of a thing and gave Daniel great revelation. And I think sometimes we just plainly give up in the small towns because we don't have the revelation of heaven. And so once we get that revelation from heaven, everything flows through relationship. Once God speaks, we have something to stand on from that moment, and then we have something to believe, and we have something to project to the people that this is what I believe God is speaking to us about this community. Let's go for it. Here's our strategy. And so without that, I think you just go through cyclical patterns of discouragement. And because it is difficult sometimes in the small towns, especially in places where people just are so locked up in tradition and not wanting to. And so I'm a firm believer that every one of our towns throughout the Dakotas, throughout Montana, every one of our little towns can have an AG representative there, whether it's a micro church in a home, or whether it's you launching a church in a building on Main Street, whatever it is. I believe we can have the kingdom of God advance through visionary leadership, pioneering spirits that say, "You know what? God has called us to take the land here. I know it's hard." We hear that all the time. "It's so hard here." Well, I get that. I understand that. But if God has put it on your heart to be there, he'll give you the vision and the plan to see it through. And that is you becoming desperate, saying, "I know, God, you've called me here. I haven't seen what I've wanted to see." And that's when you get desperate. And that's when you start to do things that you thought, you would have never do. Like one of the things that we did in Webster, because we were desperate. We didn't know where to start. We didn't know where to begin. I remember saying, "Let's gather a group of people. Let's pray around the community." We would go pray around the community. We would pray down streets. Well, the next time we did it, we knocked on doors. We knocked on doors and told them,
Very nice.
"We have a church here, Freedom Church, and we're just knocking on doors. We just want to pray for you." There wasn't hardly anyone that turned down prayer. In fact, when we did those journeys, we would always run across someone that was interested and became a part of our church. I remember one particular person who became a part of the Webster Church. She found out they're walking down the street. Some of our people were walking down the street and ran into her, and they explained to her that they were a Pentecostal church. She goes, "I've been living here in Webster for I don't know how many years," she said, "and I never knew there was a Pentecostal." Well, there hasn't been. We're just starting one, and she
Sure.
was really excited about it, became a part of the church. I remember praying and fasting at the beginning of the year, like we always do. We didn't have a church at this time, and a building. What I should say, a building, not a church. We had a church. We didn't have a building, and we
Sure.
were praying and fasting at the Ramkota Theater in Aberdeen, South Dakota. And we were crying out to God. We were praying in tongues real loud. And all of a sudden, someone opens the door, looks in, and I went over there and greeted them. I said, "Can I help you?" And she goes, "Are you guys praying in tongues?" And granted, this is before we started the church in
Yeah, and
Webster.
you never know like what your response is gonna set the tone for
Right.
next. It's like if I say yes, are you more mad or are you less mad? I don't know.
Right. And I was like, "Where is this going?" So we're in this little small theater in a hotel, and right across the way there's like some type of a, I don't know, some type of a truck show or something like that that's going on. This lady peeps her head in and she's like, "Are you guys praying in tongues?" And granted, remember this, it's we haven't started the Freedom Church in Webster yet. And I said, "Yeah, we are praying in tongues." She goes, "Oh my goodness, this is amazing." She goes, "I'm a Pentecostal person, but I'm not from around here." I said, "Well, where are you from?" She goes, "I'm from Webster." I said, "Well, hey, I want to invite you to our small
Do I have
group."
some news for you? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so she became a part of our church too. So, I just think anything that God is putting in your heart to do, follow through with it, be obedient, and watch God open doors for you. So desperation is huge, absolutely.
Yeah, man. So, another practical question just on the subject of church planting and like what it looks like to see the move of God. But can small town churches plant churches? That's just a fun question of curiosity because I think sometimes we disqualify ourselves, and so it can help to like build a roadmap there. Like, is that even possible? What does that look like, you know?
Was it possible for the Apostle Paul to plant churches?
Sure.
In other words, what I'm saying and what I'm getting at is if there's a person that God has put his hand on to plant churches, that person will fulfill that calling if they stay on task. And that person doesn't have to be part of a mega church or a church over 200. And when we were in Aberdeen, we weren't even over 200 at that time. It's someone that has a. I'm praying for this, Joe, as more people will have kind of an apostolic spirit about them, a pioneering spirit about them, whether that's small town, big town. I know that there are, I believe even our Webster campus now. I'm here in Sioux Falls living, and now as a superintendent, I know that they are shepherding some people over in a nearby town, and they're just wondering what's going to come of this. It could become a church, possibly. Absolutely. And let's get the model too, that it doesn't have to be, this 9 month period, then we launch in a building somewhere. I think that in some of these real small towns that are 300 or under, or 400 or 500 and under, they could start in a home with a Bible study, with a small group, and from there it just begins to grow and grow. So absolutely. And I don't think it costs $100,000 to plant one. Now, some people will disagree, but
Sure.
I different models, and I get it, in different areas, absolutely it'll cost a lot of money. But when you're talking small towns of Dakotas, I'm not sure that it will cost that much.
Yeah, absolutely. I love viewing it again as a how can we find a way in? What's the opportunity? It's kind of expanding our view of what church even looks like to say, like, hey, when we say planting a church, you know, the Apostle Paul didn't have buildings and he didn't have, you know, he was just finding people and saying, well, keep doing this, keep getting together, you know, and learn about the Lord. And so I love kind of the picture that you paint there of having this broad on ramp for this kind of conversation. So switching gears a little bit, kind of leaning into your experience in all sorts of church context, kind of your experience really in ministry now as superintendent, you have frequent interactions with churches, you know what I'm saying, and kind of church leadership styles and different things. And I was really intrigued when we were talking on the phone by your conversation about like church boards in generally. And like, you know, we have, I think for each pastor, especially small town pastors, church boards can be one of the most life-giving or one of the most life-draining things that exists in a local church. You know, you might have these deeply entrenched leaders that are either your best champions or they are the ones trying to show you the door every fourth week. You know what I'm saying? And so we'll just take each of these thoughts in turn. You know, we'll talk about longevity in the rural church. We'll talk about these different things as they relate to leadership. But Let's start with this idea. Let's say, a church is in a good situation or a pastor is new to a church. How does a pastor keep a board in its proper place and not let a church become a board-run church? You know what I'm saying? Like, let's say we're not, stuck there yet, but like, how do we practice these certain things that help create a good balance of authority shared between the pastor and the board? What does that health look like?
I want to go back 25, 26 years ago when I traveled full time. I want to go back there because that's when I first began to experience this. I became a person where the pastors would talk to because I was the guest, I was leaving, and I had these conversations several times back in the early 2000s with pastors struggling with their boards, struggling with them crossing lines of authority. And here's what I began to discover back when I was an evangelist was in a matter of a very short time, there was turnaround in a lot of these churches where
Sure.
pastor would come in, get discouraged, leave. The next pastor would come in, get discouraged, leave. The next pa And it wasn't just because of the board. It was just because they felt alone. They didn't see breakthroughs like they wanted to. Many of our small towns are like that. And so they would get discouraged. And after a while, the board members, they were like being very as flexible as they possibly could, I think, in situations. But when they saw so much turnaround, it was hard for them, I think, to embrace the next vision that was coming on the plate.
Sure.
Because in their minds, how long is this person going to
Yeah,
be
one
here?
more hired hand in a sense. It's like, well, cool, but they're going to leave again, you know?
Right. And so when there's not longevity and there's turnaround, then the board will automatically say, we've got to have more of a voice here. We've got to take authority here because this person's going to leave anyway. So that was one issue I saw. So saying that, I do think longevity is important in these small towns. And I think that with longevity comes trust. And I think that you can't just come in to a place and demand trust. Let me give you an example. When Freedom Church Aberdeen was asked, when I was asked to help out the church in Miller, I was really kind of wanting to know what the end game of the district was. And their end game was, is we would like Miller to become a Freedom Church, just so they have
Sure.
consistent accountability and consistent help. So when I came in there, I didn't put the hammer down and say, okay, this is D-Day, we're taking over.
Yeah.
And there's different ways of doing this. I get that. In some
Sure.
cases, you may have to come into community and shut it all down. I get that. There's different approach. But for Miller, they weren't like that. They were really good people, good board members, but some of them were a little skeptical. And I get that. I get that because they've had so much change, and just with that change, they were without a pastor for a couple of years.
Sure.
And so I didn't come in there and just right away, just, I got to know them, built relationships for about a year. Then after a year, they were in. They were like, yes, we want to become a Freedom Church. And from that point, we were able to build a new leadership team there. So what happens though, too, I think, is without that longevity, without that trust, some board members may just assume that they're the boss,
Sure.
and make it difficult for the pastor. One way they can make it difficult is micromanaging every decision that pastor wants to make. And I think once again, as the pastor, you, in a sense, you have to come, you have to be integrous. You have
Sure.
to be, a hardworking person. You have to build that community. You've got to be there when your people are, at the hospitals. You've got to be available. You can't be removed from them, distant from them. There has to be some type of commitment that you make that shows them that you're there for the people. And from that basis, though, you begin to build this relationship built upon trust, and then you begin to lead the vision. you begin to share the vision, lead the vision. Maybe sometimes pastors don't express the vision, don't share the vision. Some say I'm not a visionary person. Well, I
Sure.
think if you're the leader, you need to become somewhat of a
Sure.
visionary
I know
person.
there's that. I feel like there was always these two kind of competing theories where someone says, well, as a pastor, you kind of play to your strengths and staff to your weaknesses. And like, that's all like a good theology or a good thought, sure. But it doesn't mean we remain like incompetent in areas that we still have to try and like get a baseline level of, like, well, I'm not an extrovert. It's like, well, you still have to learn how to greet and shake hands and be hospitable. And like, you still have to do that as a pastor. Like, you don't get that luxury. And small town, especially, I think we would agree, like, man, there's no staff to staff. There's no money to bring in people that are different than you in a sense. Like, you just kind of have to start doing the baseline here, And so I love, sorry, continue on, but I love that thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, as a pastor, you got to call those things that aren't as if they were. And meaning you may come into a tough situation. And if you're always complaining about that tough situation, are you changing that situation? No, you're not. You got to start seeing things the way God wants them to become and start praying those things to happen and start speaking those things to happen. And don't go, oh, my board just stinks because of this, this, and that. That doesn't get you to the next level. Having a vision for that area, having a plan, and begin speaking that and communicating that. And there are times where you will have to have crucial conversations with board members if they're just not relinquishing control and they're wanting to, and how they do that sometimes is they have the meeting after the meeting, with another board
Yeah,
member.
no, yeah, I've seen a few of those.
So the meeting after the meeting, is always something that you don't want as a pastor. But I think another thing too that we haven't talked about is church structure and governance, constitution, bylaws, which is really makes a lot of people yawn. But for me, I think it's a make or break thing. When you
Sure.
have governances, when you have constitution bylaws that are 30, 40, 50, 60 years old, are they really speaking the language of where we're at today? In some cases, yes, with our 16 fundamental truths, absolutely. But there's certain things that we do in our constitution, bylaws, governances that was good for the 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe 70s and 80s. But we have to find a different way. There's a new wineskin, right? There's a new way
Yeah.
of doing things. So things are not bottlenecked so much. And maybe there was a reason why the pastor had to ask the board if he wanted to spend $200. Maybe there was a reason 40 years ago, but today there might not be. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
We bottleneck our decisions, decision making, and it just kind of holds things back a little bit. There's just, I have issue with some of our old governance and constitution bylaws. And I think they have to reflect, where we're at today and where we're going. And they also, of course, they tie in with each district and having oversight there. I think that's super important. But I think there are different just models that would be helpful for the small town.
Absolutely. I love the pragmatism of that, this idea of like, longevity becomes the way we build currency. We do take a deep look at like our governance. I mean, I think you're right. Policy can feel boring, but it's also what guides organizations, and it's what your deacons will quote to you when things go awry. They're leaning on it too. And so follow-up question to that, just kind of probing a little deeper in one of the areas we've talked about. When it comes to helping a board get unstuck, you're talking a pastor comes in, and sure, yes, we can say, well, the passage of time will yield great fruit. And yes, there's this relational building, but maybe break down the one or two ways that, let's say right away a pastor comes into a church and notices, man, this board is entrenched in kind of this power struggle feeling. Like, obviously, barring the outcome that, oh, it's insurmountable and the pastor leaves, let's say there's a way forward. What are the one or two very pragmatic ways a pastor can just start building that trust right away?
Yeah, that's super, super good question. Really simple. Follow through with commitments you make. When you do cast vision, make sure that you have a plan to follow through on that vision so you're not just bloviating and sharing things but never following through. That breaks down trust. And I learned that as a young pastor, young leader. That's one thing. When you say something, let's follow through. What's the plan of fulfilling this? Secondly, I've said this before, I'll say it again, but prayer and fasting begins to break down some of those things where there's a tight hole on the board, and you do your job in the secret place, and God will reward you, right? It talks about giving in secret, praying in secret, fasting in secret, and then God will reward you. And I think that that is definitely something that we need to implement in our lives. I believe that we as pastors and leaders, we have to become very familiar with just getting tools in our hands with boardmanship. That we have to simply get knowledge of things. I know Dick Hardy with leaders.church, he does some things with boards that can give you some information about how to effectively lead a board. And so a lot of pastors have never led a board, have never led a team of deacons and elders, and they're just learning. And so they're kind of stumbling through it. But if they can get educated in that, they can certainly be more empowered with the knowledge they get and how to lead with vision, how to lead with mission, how to lead with core values, what kind of culture are we trying to establish here? And once that pastor begins to get that important information, knowledge, understanding of how to lead a board, that's going to be impactful, and it's going to he will be able to implement that into his board meetings. But also once in a while, maybe he needs to have a retreat with his board. Maybe they need to go away for 3 days and maybe talk a little bit about, this and the role of a board, the expectations of a board, and then just have some fun together, break bread together, do some community together and build from there. I think that that's super practical and important.
Absolutely. I love kind of the multiple approaches you had there. This idea of arm yourself with knowledge, but also move things in the spirit that can only be moved in the spiritual realms. I love your consistent commitment weaving through this, even this conversation, to prayer and fasting is kind of the way to see God move. And man, I feel like just reflecting on that is a good place to end for today. But I want to say, Pastor Drew, thank you so much for your contributions, for your conversation. I feel like I'm walking away with several nuggets to chew on. So I just want to say thank you for being part of the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it. And great talking to you. And many blessings on your state and all the states around here that are planting churches in the small towns.
Absolutely. Well, from all of us at Real Advancement, we just want to say once again, we hope you are leaving these conversations challenged and encouraged and equipped. We do want you to know that we're not just playing armchair quarterback here, that we are talking to people who have been where you're at, who know the value of what God is doing in these small, out-of-the-way places. As usual, there's all sorts of formal ways to connect with Rural Advancement. You can go to our website, ruraladvancement.com. You can find us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. But true to rural form, the best way to spread this podcast around is just to find another rural leader and say, hey, I've got a couple of conversations I'd love you to hear. So for this week, I've been your host, Joe Epley. He has been Pastor Drew Becker, and we will see you next week.